I don't know why I've had like a series of Brits on the podcast recently. I just had a poet from London, and then I had a friend from Brighton down there in the south, and I was just like, how do I have like four Brits in a row coming on the podcast? But
Have you been to Britain?
when I was younger, yes, I went to London as a kid with my parents, and then Edinburgh. So I was like 13 at the time, but like, yeah, I remember at the time it was like a mad cow disease was going around in the news, and everybody was, my mother was freaking out about like, oh, don't eat any meat when you're traveling. Don't eat any meat when you're traveling. That's like my biggest memory. That and like the castles. And it was August in London, so it was pretty pretty hot compared to where I grew up over here in the States. But
But I married an American, so I've been many
there
times.
you go. Yeah, and you have a trip coming up here for that Edgar Award.
Oh yeah, gosh, yeah, it's only a couple of weeks. Yeah, I can't believe how close it is.
Yeah, well, that's great, man. That's fantastic. That's I mean, that's exciting, right? Like you're even, I guess, even if you don't get it, right? I mean, even though you deserve to get it, right? Like
Thank you.
it's just fun to go over there and be in the mix of it all, you know, get that recognition.
I'm very excited to be over there and just to be in the Marriott Hotel and with all those offers and it's a dream come true. I think I knew when I was writing it at the back of my mind would this get nominated for an Edgar because I've written previous books but they were slightly smaller academic books so. None had ever quite made it to kind of Edgar levels, whereas this one, thankfully, generated quite a lot of buzz. So,
I was looking up stuff. I didn't. There were like a lot of Stephen Powells when I was researching and digging in here to write this intro. Yeah, it's strange. I kept seeing these Stephen Powells. There was like a Stephen D. Powells. Like, that's not him. And then there was like another Stephen Powell that was like an American guy. I was like, that's not him.
it's not there's one in Utah who I think was involved in various kind of kidnappings and I think there was an Amazon documentary about him a very strange Stephen Powell unfortunately. I made the mistake of setting up a Google alert on my name and I've been inundated with stories of rapists, murderers, swindlers,
Good content though,
No,
I
I
just
mean it's a really common name. In fact, there's a cancer specialist at the university I work at. There's a Dr. Stephen Powell, and occasionally get calls from people. Apparently, he's quite renowned in his field, so I occasionally get calls from people asking about chemotherapy and all this sorts of thing. And I'm just like, I'm sorry, I'm nowhere near clever enough or qualified to help you.
Bored.
Heavy.
I am heavy, heavy, heavy
bored.
Andrew Wittstat, and you are listening to Heavy Board, and we're recording this on April 18th, 2024. My guest today is the author Stephen Powell, one of the leading scholars of American crime fiction in the English-speaking world. A member of the Crime Writers Association and an honorary fellow in the English department at the University of Liverpool, Stephen has written and edited several books, including James Ellroy, Demon Dog of Crime Fiction, 100 American Crime Writers, The Big Somewhere, Essays on James Ellroy's Noir World, and Conversations with James Ellroy, among others, as well as several chapters and essays in scholarly anthologies about crime fiction and noir. And his latest book is Changing the Game Yet Again, a comprehensive biography of the main figure in all of Stephen's work, the great American crime writer James Ellroy, entitled Love Me Fierce in Danger, The Life of James Ellroy, available now from Bloomsbury, and of course is linked in the description of this episode, listeners. And Love Me Fierce in Danger has just been shortlisted for a 2024 Edgar Award in the category of Best Critical Biographical Work, as well as a Keating Award in the same category. And it deserves it, listeners. Love Me Fierce and Danger has been called a masterpiece of literary biography by David Peace, and praised by Mark Sanderson in The Times as having all the pace and twists and shock of a good crime novel. Stephen also owns and operates The Venetian Vase, an online salon that includes a combination of blogs, interviews, essays, musings, comprehensive crime fiction research, an overall archive of his work with James Ellroy, as well as an overall bibliography for all of Stephen's work, available at venetianvase.co.uk. He owns and operates a podcast titled Highbrow Lowbrow with his co-host Dan Slattery, and has recently launched a YouTube channel called Ellroy Reader, where Stephen reads, reviews, and discusses novels and other works of fiction. I first came across Stephen and his work when he began popping into my Twitter feed. His latest book on Ellroy gaining some much-deserved attention from all the various podcasts and websites and magazines in the crime fiction and noir world. His impressive contributions drawing the interest of crime fiction lovers all over the planet. And I asked Stephen on today to be given the heavy board treatment, going into his work on Ellroy and other crime writers, but also his own life and techniques as a writer of fiction and nonfiction, scholarly and pop. And I'm thrilled to bring his particular flavor of writing, reading, and comprehensive study to all of you out there. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on.
Hello, Andrew. Thank you for inviting me on. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, my pleasure to have you here. Looking forward to this.
Me too.
I always like to start this off with kind of more personal questions about the writer themselves. When I say, what was your childhood like? You know, how did you grow up? Where? And then to kind of gear that towards something, how did that lead you towards reading and writing?
Well, my childhood was mostly happy. I have very fond memories of my father. He was a cell operator at a chemical plant. And he didn't have much schooling, but he was a great autodidact. And he introduced me to novels at a very early age. So at the ages of, say, 11 or 12, I was reading Ian Fleming's James Bond novels and Bernard Cornwell's Sharp novels. Anything with a sense of adventure, anything with a sense of otherness. You know, I grew up in a small town, Chester, in the UK, which is, it's quite beautiful. It's an old Roman town, but it's also extremely dull. There's not much going on, so I love a good story. I love a good journey in fiction and in fact, and I love to be taken somewhere and to escape into the realms of the imagination, and that's what I found authors did to me. James Ellroy came a bit later. I was reading a lot of authors before I got to Ellroy. I got to him about 16, but by that age, I'd gone through quite a few, and I suppose Ellroy was special. I don't want to jump too far ahead in your program. I suppose Ellroy was special because obviously you're taking me to America, which almost has this kind of mystical, mythical quality over here in Britain. Even though we speak the same language, it is a very alluring, sexy, violent, bit dangerous place in England, you know, at least that's what the newspapers tell us and films and TV. So I really loved Ellroy for introducing me to Los Angeles and noir and those sorts of things. It was opening a whole new world for me.
Yeah, that's always funny. I always said, like, the way that, I guess we always romanticize each other, the way Americans romanticize England, you know, in the UK. We're like, oh, this beautiful, quaint, old place that has these castles and these stone buildings, and look at the Parliament, look at that building, yeah. Like, you know, yeah. And it's always a two-way street, I guess, with that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you started reading out as a child, like young child, like preteens, yeah. Kind of, when you got into the crime stuff.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact age. I know it was very, very young. And I know my dad introduced me to basically novels. I didn't read that much kind of children's literature I just read his books. So I would raid his shelves. And it was the age, really. I mean, my dad grew up in that kind of post-war paperback boom, and he just loved a good novel. So I would just raid his shelves, and then we'd talk about the books. And like me, he was a bit of a dreamer. He hadn't had much chance to travel, and he hadn't had a breakout career. He didn't really like his job, so he had the same kind of slightly romantic attachment to a good story and to a good fantasy, with a small F, because he didn't actually like speculative fiction. He preferred a better grounding in reality. But yeah, we I think writers are born dreamers, and readers and writers, we just share that love of what Alroy might call the wonder,
Right,
the just otherness, that there's just something really great out there that you need to explore through adventure or just travel or some kind,
absolutely. And it's always like you said, I always like the next one I like to go into usually is what were some of the first writers you were enamored with, or like kind of your go-to inspiration? You said Fleming. Like I'm running a series on doing some of the James Bond books here with a fellow Brit over there, and it's always interesting going through kind of Fleming's stuff with his like just how I say like the early crime guys, especially American or British, they were enamored with these kind of I always say like the kind of modernist writers, like the Hemingway and these kind of writers that just the prose is incredibly clean. It's incredibly to the point and actually quite literary. Crime always gets a bad rap for, oh, that's crime stuff, but it's like, no. Like, read this stuff. Like, it is incredible. So yeah, who were some of the first? You said Fleming, and obviously we're gonna get to Elroy here, but
Bernard Cornwell was a big influence on me. I loved the Sharp novels, and I think, although his prose wasn't quite as clean as Fleming, maybe because the historical situations he did, which was like the Peninsula War and the Napoleonic Wars. He Bernard Cornwell was very, very good at taking you to another century, putting you in it, and making it seem so vibrant and real and alive. Because as a kid, I just found it hard to imagine just living in another century without all of the conveniences I had as a kid. It just blew my mind. And Cornwell was the first person, Bernard Cornwell was the first person who made it seem possible. Of course, now I look back and think, I was a kid, I didn't have the internet, and because but I'm glad I didn't now, because that would have totally distracted me. So Bernard Cornwell's Sharp novels, he wrote a few set in America in the US Civil War as well, but he actually abandoned that series. I could give you some names. I'm not sure how well all of them have translated across the Atlantic. Jack Higgins was a big one, and he was very prolific. He wrote, I'm trying to think of a few that were filmed. The Eagle Has Landed was filmed, Prayer for the Dying. But he could write two, three novels a year. And that really taught me. He was the king of the paperback thriller, and I used to devour his books. And then after a while, I began to realize they were all the same. And I remember almost feeling cheated by it. Really, I almost felt like a sense of animosity towards Mr. Higgins after reading, say, a dozen or so of his books. And I kind of went off him. I guess that's important in itself, just becoming disillusioned with a writer. There were others I remember feeling a bit heartbroken for different reasons. I remember reading a lot of Eric Ambler, the spy writer, espionage writer, however you want to write it. But his work really tailed off probably after World War II. And reading his books in orders, I just really noticed the quality dipping, and he lost a certain dynamism. It was almost like, as our body fails, there was like an energy level that went down in his books. That being quite heart-rending. Those were probably the earliest, and then going forward later, I became more interested in kind of, maybe more mature writers who are more interested in like the human condition, like say P.D. James, I'm a huge fan of. Recently, Mo Hayder. Oh gosh, there's so many.
That's what I always, and yeah, like my question is, you know, I'm a big McDonald fan. Ross McDonald, love his stuff, and I guess mine are more American. But, Chandler, I like some, not all, right? Like he's, I feel like sometimes he's inconsistent, but again, his prose is always surprisingly clean for, because it became like a factory thing, you know, like that kind of noir writing, especially in America in the early part of the 20th century. If it was like a factory almost, where they had these guys that they're paying, you know, a couple cents a word or whatever, cranking out these novels, you know, in 3 months, you know. But then you see the greats in, and Hammett, obviously, was Hammett in there. And
absolutely. It's interesting because I hear a lot of writers today say, oh, I can't make any money in this, and I really wish I was born at the wrong time. but what they don't realize is most of those writers of Black Mask and of the 30s and 40s, Black Mask magazine, a lot of them were just exploited and really didn't make – it wasn't a sustainable career for them, you know, and the industry was changed. Great writers like Charles Williams and David Goodis, many of them died broke, and it was hard for them. I think they would be amazed, and even Chandler and Hammett would kind of be amazed at the critical attention their work is getting today. I'm sure they'd be delighted in a slightly noir way, but yeah, at the time they were just kind of for the pulp grinder type writers.
That's interesting. I didn't prepare for this, but when do you think that started, the kind of scholarly interest in the kind of crime and noir? Because you're involved in this, so you're in the university setting doing the important scholarly work like this. And I know like the Library of America over here has recently really made an effort in like the last 30, 40 years to kind of immortalize at least the American crime writers on this side of the, you know, this side of the pond, as they say. But yeah, when did that kind of start, this scholarly interest in that?
Yeah, I think it started like the late 80s, early 90s, and I think it started with probably improving popularity of American studies in general, both like the American Academy gaining more confidence in studying American writers and this huge movement in American fiction, which contrasted nicely with a lot of the more British tradition, which was kind of golden age detective fiction, a lot of locked room mysteries and kind of very class bound fiction. So the American one is almost kind of oppositional to that. And it just snowballs, you know, a couple of articles are published and then that just starts a dialogue. People write articles in response to that. Then suddenly you get monographs, you get anthologies of essays. And the only thing I can say is, you know, some academics excel at just studying one thing in particular or one writer in particular. When I started my Alroy PhD, there weren't any books on Alroy. Then in like my first year, a book came out by Peter Wolf called Like Hot Knives of the Brain, which was a fairly decent scholarly book on him. And then there was another one by a German academic, a wonderful woman called Anna Pfluger. And that was James Elroy and the novel of Obsession. And I remember thinking, actually, oh no, that there's going to be an avalanche and I won't have anything left to write about him. But as it turned out that, you know, I started writing about him, I got my books out about him. And now I'm being asked to blurb scholarly books about Elroy every couple of years. There's at least half a dozen. And a colleague of mine, by the name of Nathan Ashman, who works at University of East Anglia, he and I are guest editors of a special James Elroy issue of the journal Clues, a Journal of Detection, which is the premium scholarly journal about crime fiction. So we're guest editing an issue on Elroy, and that will be coming out in 2026, which might seem like a long time away, but in the world of academia, like next weekend. So we're working hard on that, and we're just really excited. And we're finding that it's easier now. Publishers will listen to you if you come to them with a really good scholarly subject in the crime fiction field. And yeah, it's been the last 30 years or so that it's just opened up.
Yeah, I'm curious your thoughts on this. With like, I as I said, I love Ross McDonald on the American side, and he, I guess you mentioned, yeah, these kind of mystery books and things, and kind of the Conan Doyle style with these detective or detective going through. McDonald had that essay years ago, I believe, where was it in the Atlantic or something, where he talked about tracing the kind of, because, you know, McDonald was kind of, I guess, the more scholarly guy. He was a PhD holder that was doing this kind of stuff, and about tracing the kind of American crime novel or crime story to Poe and Edgar Allan Poe's kind of writing. I'm just curious, your thoughts on that, theories on that, or what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, I think McDonald's view is perfectly valid in as far as it goes, and Margaret Miller as well was a great thinker, you know. I think the problem with, if you try to find the genesis of crime fiction and you put one starting point, someone's always going to find something before that. I mean, I've noticed critics even trace crime fiction like back to biblical writing, you know, canonical books of the Bible, and the arguments they've set forth, like certain, like, or even just the disciples using tradecraft to keep the Last Supper a secret, or something like that, you know, all of stories, mysteries in the Book of Daniel, and those sorts of things, are really, really interesting. Of course, very few writers. Well, maybe it's different now because it's a commercial proposition, but very few writers actually think, I'm going to write a book in this particular literary movement. They have their influences, of course, but most writers just have a story they want to tell. And as it happens, it tends to fit into a certain genre. But I mean, obviously, there are masters of the genre that we revere, and I mean, I think Poe is one of them. And in a sense, similar things were happening in Britain at the time with like the Penny Dreadfuls, but also in a literary perspective, you know, Dickens is often regarded as one of the all-time great mystery writers.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I'm a big Dickens fan too, and I think of the writers from that era, Dickens stuff kind of tends to hold up the best. You know, reading it 200 years later, you're like, oh wow, it's still, the jokes still work. You know, like all of that, and the mysteries and all that. That's very interesting. Yeah, I guess it's hard to determine. Yeah, and that's part of the fun of scholarship is like, oh, you know, kind of where did this come from? Who did it first? How did it snowball into over thousands of years? And very interesting to think about. Yeah. But all right, yeah, that's very good. So we got Stephen Powell coming in, young kid reading some novels, and then turning into when did you start getting into the scholarly side? Was it college or?
Yeah, well, so I did an English degree, and you know, in the UK, you usually just pick a subject and you do a degree on that thing. It's like different in America when you do a couple of years and then you major in something. And then it happens, there's an American to blame for this. I met my wife. My wife Diane is from Detroit, and I met her at the University of Liverpool, and she said she knew I was obsessed with James Ellroy. And I didn't think I could do a PhD on him because there was no scholarly writing on him. You know, he was even younger then. He would have been in his late 50s, I suppose. Or he was still writing. It takes time. And of course, this is this prejudice. most writers who are having articles written about them, scholarly articles, are usually dead.
Right.
So I said, I really don't know if I can do one on Ellroy, but her encouragement and a wonderful professor at the University of Liverpool, Professor David Seed, he was very keen on the idea. He said, I think Ellroy would be a marvelous writer to write about. And so I started started, I remember in my first year, I remember thinking, wouldn't it be great if out of all this PhD stuff, if I actually got to meet the man? I think that was probably my only ambition, to know him on any personal level, to meet him. Maybe have a real one-to-one with him. Little did I know that not only would I get to meet him, I'd get to write his biography. I'd spend hundreds of hours talking to him. But again, that's a bit further down the road.
Yeah, so when you were doing your PhD on it, was this the early aughts?
Let's see. Yeah, I actually did my first two books were published before I finished my PhD. I had to take a break. So they were published in 2012, and I think I finally graduated in 2015. The years kind of merge into
Oh,
one.
yes.
Yeah, and actually, James Ellroy, Demon Dog of Crime Fiction, which was published by Palgrave, that was my monograph. That started as my PhD, and I rewrote it to kind of monograph specifications. I kind of rewrote the arguments in it a bit more. I mean, the ba basic argument of my PhD, which I thought was kind of revolutionary. I'm not sure if it is really, but I was very much interested in Ellroy's demon dog persona, and I very much wanted to argue that it's not just about him howling in bookshops and just being a bit outrageous and, being a bit right wing and telling very blackly comic jokes and that sort of thing. I really feel, I use the present tense because I still think it's valid, it is that the demon dog persona was in itself a kind of narrative device, and that the demon dog is both on the page, but he could use it externally, through his many media appearances. And it was very, very finely honed persona. And I tried to trace the honing of that persona as much as I could. And then a few years ago, when I was writing the biography, I interviewed Andrew Vax, the novelist, the crime novelist, who wrote the Burke novels, who knew Ellroy for a few years. They were friends. And he told me, well, the thing with James is he tried on a few personas before he found one that fit. And that really opened my eyes to it, because I felt like, well, we know him as the demon dog. We have this very specific view of Ellroy. He's got a completely unique look. His physiognomy is completely unique. His voice, his cadence, his jokes are almost completely unique. Wouldn't it have been interesting if he'd have chosen something else other than that? Or if he'd, if he tried to be more like Tom Wolfe or something? That really would have been fascinating. I think, American literary history of the past 20 years would have been very different if he'd have chosen a different persona.
That's so interesting. I just had a conversation with someone for this podcast that was about artists and their personas, and this kind of, Brittany Sinelis, the American writer, has talked about this, where he said there was the real him, and then there was kind of this media version of him, where, and then you can lean into it, you can lean out of it, you can create your own, you can reinvent that persona. A lot of artists do that and throughout time. And but yeah, Ellroy is that, yeah, that the crazy shirts and the documentaries, the car, right? Like the car, what was that documentary when he's driving around in that convertible in LA? And yeah, that's just, it's so fascinating to see, and how you can use that to your advantage, like not just in media appearances, but in the art creation too, is just so, I mean, that's so fascinating. Yeah, like for that's fantastic. I'm glad you're doing this work that you're doing this work,
Oh,
and
thank you.
especially for somebody like Ellroy, where, yeah, like I said, okay, so this was, your first couple books on this, 2011, 2012-ish, 2013-ish, was nobody was really doing that. And I guess, yeah, Ellroy was still alive, and it was only, he'd been publishing, what, like 30 years at that point. And yeah, to take that on is just fantastic. Yeah. What, how did you first discover Ellroy? And you mentioned a little bit about this being kind of a young kid and just getting those big doorstop novels of his, the details, the twists, the turns, the kind of, how did, what got you into Ellroy? How did you first discover it? And then what made you fall in love with his work?
I first discovered him. My first Elroy book was American Tabloid. So I started pretty big and pretty kind of late career. What was then late career? Because I was 16. I was on holiday on the south coast of England, a little place called Bournemouth, seaside resort. I was just in a bookshop. And the cover of American Tabloid, it was an artist's rendition of the Kennedy cavalcade in Dallas, November 1963. And it was a striking image, so I picked up the book, I bought it, didn't know who James Elroy was, and just read a few pages and I was hooked. The violence, the story started right away. There's an immediacy to it that really impressed me. Like he had a great confidence in pushing you into the maelstrom of events. So and the book itself, that one was designed as like the inside scoop of the Kennedy assassination, which again took a lot of confidence because this being the mid-90s, we'd already had Oliver Stone's JFK, and it's a subject that everybody's got an opinion on, whether you're a lone gunman or you're conspiracy theory, which conspiracy theory. But it really felt so vivid and plausible to me that I almost felt like I was in America in 1963. That's what the best authors do. They take you somewhere. So naturally, I had to go out then and devour everything else I could find about this James Ellroy. And again, this was slightly pre-internet. So I was just looking up newspaper articles. I was reading, I was looking up newspaper articles. I just had the author photograph of this rather severe-looking bald man with this very intense stare and this obsessiveness in these author images. And I think in a way that you feed off that you I fed off his energy. The books have this remarkable energy to them. And I remember finishing books like White Jazz and being literally breathless, like I'd just been on this really f just been joyriding in a car or something, and I just had this big adrenaline rush, which we don't necessarily associate with sitting in an armchair and reading a paperback novel, but remarkably, it had given me this huge rush. So it was an obsession. And it just spiraled. When I was working on Elroy from a scholarly perspective, I think there was something at the back of my mind that felt like I'm either going to write the biography or I'm going to co-write it. I don't know, because I was collecting kind of just arcane memorabilia or just details about his life, any tiny minute detail I could find. And obviously, a lot of that wasn't really relevant to a thesis, which is an academic argument. Theses are not full of factoids. They're full of literary movement and discussion and critiques and that sort of stuff. But at the same time, I was just creating this huge inventory of facts, dates, times, places, mapping where he was. I mean, I was almost stalking the guy. I knew that was going to come in handy. I probably knew that if I found out as much as I could about his movements and what he thought on any particular subject on any day and how that would change over the time, that is essentially, yeah, I think I probably knew at the back of my mind that maybe this biography was going to happen, but.
And it was just like spiraling. Like it was just, you were 16, get that first novel, and then it was just seeking out everything that was on, everything he'd published. And I guess, yeah, that time it was the American Underworld trilogy was fully out, all of that, and you could just go one, two, three, bang him out. But
Yeah.
yeah, sorry, go on.
No, yeah. Well, I mean, so I started, yeah, so American Tabloid was first, and I read all of the Los Angeles Quartet. I remember the first one that the first time he published a new book and I'd had this obsession with him was The Cult 6000. I can remember queuing up outside Waterstones very early in the morning. Waterstones is the big UK bookseller. To buy that book. I mean, he wasn't even there, but the queues, that was his biggest hardback bestseller, still is, that he was really hitting fever pitch then. And then I remember going back and reading his very first novels, because he really hit the big time with the Black Dahlia in 1987, his seventh novel. And then I read the six he'd written prior to that. And I remember feeling maybe just a tad disappointed with them, only because they weren't extraordinary. They were just very, very, very good. And that's an ex and I think he was very much finding his voice. But those first novels, like Brown's Requiem and Clandestine, they probably do seem a little bit conventional now compared to the prose style and the plotting and just the idiosyncrasies in the text and how he made Los Angeles, particularly 1950s Los Angeles, his own. So I was devouring everything, definitely.
Yeah, and you mentioned the confidence already, and I think that's part of the appeal of him as well. Like when who was that guy who was like an old American pulp writer who had like that formula for it where he was just, and you said you mentioned as you got older noticing that you were disappointed in some of the more formulaic stuff where he said the step one is kill somebody in an unusual way, pile trouble on the hero, and then like have him get in a fight by this point, and then you kind of have these. Again, because those guys were just cranking them out like in a matter of days, for that, for pennies, and just his confidence. Yeah, what do you?
I mean, funnily enough, if you go back to the 30s and 40s, talking about writers with formulas, even though academics were ignoring them and many critics were ignoring them, but crime writers themselves were talking about what they did a lot. Yeah, they were. I mean, Chandler would talk about Ross Macdonald. He would also write about Hammett, and that's where I got the title Venetian Vase from for my website. It's from the quote, "Hammett took murder out of the Venetian vase and gave it back to the people it belonged to," because Chandler really didn't like the Golden Age British detective story. There were numerous attempts to map out the rules of detective fiction, and naturally they became quite formulaic. I mean, the writers we look for today, I mean, the writers I look for as a reader are the ones who break the formula. Fortunately, I think because pu publishing is contracting and it's got this big threat, which is the internet and people's attention spans contracting, because of the phones and whatnot, is that they're almost getting more and more formulaic and more safe. And a lot of the books I grew up with, which were kind of spy and espionage and adventure fiction, I think a lot of those have been squeezed out of the market for basically just detective fiction with a kind of dark, troubled protagonist who's a bit traumatized because of something in his or her past.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a writer I was listening to an interview, and he said just certain genres have been completely squeezed out of the industry. Like some of that adventure fiction stuff is essentially just completely gone, or it's just in the realm of self-publishing, with the big giants like Amazon, where you can just anybody could write one and put it out there. And yeah, most of them are pretty disappointing. They follow the formula, they kind of go nowhere, or they're amateur, actually, that word, whatever. But it is kind of a shame too for that. And it almost seems like, yeah, that maybe some are running out of ideas. But then you have somebody like Elroy, this giant, just keeping it alive almost. Like, who else is writing that kind of, crime noir fiction? It's, yeah, sorry.
Well, no, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I know with Elroy's recent stuff, The Enchanters, he became very nostalgic, say, a year or two before he started writing The Enchanters for the kind of Irving Wallace, Harold Robbins kind of melodramas, those kind of door-stopping mid-20th century books that were huge sellers. And he wanted to write a book that would almost be a tribute to the kind of Wallace Robbins, I mean, very consciously trashy novels, and add his own spin on it. And I thought that was, I thought that was such a brave thing to do because we don't see books like that anymore. And Elroy was going to set out and write one. I think broadly he succeeded. I think The Enchanters was one of his best novels in years, especially as someone who rather struggled with Perfidia and The Storm. some of Elra's more recent work, set during wartime and Second Ally Quartet and all being prequels and whatnot, I struggled with them. So I thought it was interesting that Elroy was going to go back to his more classic territory, but also go back to his more classic influences and the books that influenced him, mostly when he was a kid.
Yeah, there's that confidence again, right? Elroy just coming out of there, and I just like his public appearances when he just claims he's like every one of my books is a masterpiece. I'll just say that he's like only preceded by my next masterpiece. Like that's yet to come out, and just going back and being able to do that. I wonder, yeah, if and somebody that has his stature in the industry, where he'd be allowed to do something like that. Like I do look at a lot of these writers that are kind of let, I mean, not that they're letting it, not up to them necessarily, but just, yeah, if you have a little bit of sway, why not? Yeah, be confident about it and be like, yeah, I'm just gonna bring this back. I'm just gonna at least try, to bring back a big swing for the fences there. But I imagine you've spent a lot of time with Elroy himself, right? What was that like? I've heard many mixed things about this, his, and again, that confidence, the documentary filmmakers he would hire and stuff to follow him around, and yeah, what is he like?
He is, I mean, I think he would surprise you. He is a gentleman, first and foremost. And I think a lot of the rules of decorum and civility are very important to him. So, I mean, and maybe we had that kind of connection because being English, I am a little bit stiff and awkward around people, maybe upon first meeting them. But I also believe in civility first, and then kind of once I relax and become friendly with people, I usually develop an intimacy with them. And it was very much the same with him. So it was. It was really a case of gaining his trust, which would be obviously letting him do the speaking, doing 80% speaking, because he's the more important person. I'm under no illusion otherwise, but letting him talk, letting him lead the conversation, and because one of the great things I think I'd done was that I'd studied every printed interview with him. So I'd seen journalists hack him off, either, talking too much or getting too opinionated or going off subject. So what I did was very much let him lead and just let him talk. I mean, it wasn't that difficult. He's a great raconteur. He loves a good story, loves a good joke. And when you, I've got a friend who's a conflict journalist. He's South African, and he told me, because he's done a lot of very difficult interviews with kind of traumatized victims of war zones, and he said doing an interview is so easy. You're silent. You don't have to say anything because people hate silence, so they will fill that silence for you. It's a simplification, but I would just, ask leading questions, let him do the talking, and it was all fine. There were some tense moments because when you're dealing with somebody's trauma, you don't want to say anything that even has a whiff of judgmentalism about it or being insensitive. And I mean, it all depends on the prejudices of that particular person. I mean, some people don't like to talk about past relationships. I really love to talk about past relationships. He was less keen on talking about his mother. That seemed to be a big wall for him. And he'd built up all manner of defenses, all of which were quite charming in their way. I think 90% of charm is evasion, and he just built up these evasive techniques, and I just respected that. But occasionally, I'd hear him say something. He'd think of a piece of music that his mother liked, for instance, and then I would just let him lead on that because you didn't know where it might go. It might go somewhere really good. I would, you don't want to ask anything too inflammatory. Like, when did you last see your mother, or what was your last memory of your mother? That would be far too direct. So it was good. We had a good relationship. We made each other laugh. I mean, he made me laugh more, but I made him laugh a few times, which I'm very proud of.
Yeah, it's interesting. My father-in-law is a retired DC cop here in America,
Oh.
and he always said that. He said, the trick to interviewing interrogation is just don't say anything. He's like, they'll just incriminate themselves. He's like, you just let them keep talking, and it'll give you all the answers, that you're looking for.
Yeah,
But I wonder, since
absolutely.
you said this kind of like you had this idea and this kind of more academic theory, but obviously it turns out to be, I think, more true, right? Like this kind of about his persona. Like, do you think that helped you in terms of going in there? And did you do it like journalistic style, just tape recorder on the table, talking, or?
Yeah, all the conversations were recorded. I mean, a lot of this was at the height of lockdown, so it was by phone. And then I persuaded him finally to do Zoom. And but obviously, I've met him. I've spent time with him in person. Probably the hairiest moment was, and this is all a matter of record now, but one of Alroy's ex-partners, a woman by the name of Erica Schickel, wrote a memoir called The Big Hurt about it was about her life, but it was also about her relationship with James Ellroy. This was after a second divorce in the late noughties. Now, the relationship had been tempestuous, it had been passionate. And I'd interviewed Erica, and Ellroy didn't have a problem with me interviewing Erica. He was keen for me to interview everyone. And I like Erica a lot. I think she's a marvelous woman. And but Alroy naturally didn't want to read this memoir, which he thought was just going to be a kiss and tell. So I read it for him. I read it, and I went into a meeting with him and had to tell him everything that was in it. And that was a bit nerve-wracking, as you can imagine. And it was also quite funny because it was, I think, about halfway through the interview of me explaining everything that was in this book that Erica had written, Alroy began to look at me as if I was Erica. And it was like we were having this couple's tiff. And he was just like, no, that's not true. And, no, I never said that. It's like, how could you think that? And I was just, oh my gosh, it was tense. But at the end, he was totally disarming, and he took it all quite well, considering it kind of been an easy conversation for him to have. And he
If you're hearing this, it's because you are listening to the free public feed of Heavy Board. To get complete, uncensored, uninterrupted, full access to this podcast, become a subscriber at patreon.com/heavyboard. That's right, Heavy Board is made possible by subscribers like you. For less than one cup of coffee per month, you will receive private access to uncensored, full-length episodes, Jerk Shop, heavy bonus content, subscribers-only AMA episodes, bonus extended interviews, and more. Come join the conversation today at patreon.com/heavyboard.
Just flashed this brilliant smile and said, "Oh, you never have to worry about telling me anything, Steve." And he was quite disarming about it. So that was
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that you recorded all this too, with your kind of your transcripts and all that, and put it out with this, because it is, even if it's not like a bestseller or anything, I mean, you just think 50, 100 years from now, how many writers do we actually have that intimate transcript with? It's just, you're doing
Yeah.
God's work over there, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
And getting to your book here, again, listeners, linked in the description, pick up a copy. What was the process like for you writing such a comprehensive, biography like this? And how did that affect you? Like most writing, I assume it took something from you, right? Like you said, telling these stories, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of, what draws us into writers and creativity. And then even, I think, scholarship too. Like, so you, as you said, at least some energy it takes from you or things like that. So yeah, what was that process like writing such a comprehensive thing?
Well, I mean, the process existed on many levels. So, like, there would be the conversations with Alroy, which were regular and which were updates often from me about what I've been doing, but also him filling out chapters of his life and talking about things. Getting interviews with everyone I could lay my hands on. So, friends, colleagues, ex-partners again was a big one because he's had a very active love life. And that was interesting because you'd have to send out many, many interview requests and then do follow-ups. Some of it would be easy. For instance, he has a knack for dating academics and literary agents, probably because you date people in the same profession as you, I guess. So those people tend to have a public profile, so I just got lucky there. But also to get the interviews with the Hollywood people, you'd have to go through their agents, their lawyers, their managers. So it was just constantly knocking at people's doors, digitally speaking. And of course, there was the writing itself. So the volume of material I was getting in was huge. People were really opening up. And for a guy who lived his life in the public eye, as Elroy has, I was amazed at how much new material I was getting from people. So I'd say to your listeners, if you think you know Alroy because you've read My Dark Places, his memoir, you've got to read the biography because there was so much material I was getting that was completely new. And a lot of people had like friends, and the friendship interviews were very much like the ex-girlfriend interviews because he tended to treat his friends in a similar way. There'd be a kind of seduction, there'd be a period of great activity where he would shower them with affection, and then he'd cut them off very abruptly. So the friends often felt like jilted lovers, but when I approached these people, it was almost like, "Yeah, I knew Alroy. What took you so long?" They had this "I've been waiting for you" feeling about them, even though I didn't know these people. But it was almost like, "I've really been waiting to tell this story about how I knew Alroy," because they witnessed history, and everybody wants to say, "I was there. I saw that, or I did that." And so it was a frantic case of the volume of material getting in was huge, writing it up into narrative form at the same time. And of course, I have all the responsibilities, I have academic responsibilities as well. And so it was a really, really busy time in my life. But like I say, a lot of it was over lockdown. So I was very, very lucky that I had a great lockdown. It was fascinating. I was never bored. It was absolutely wonderful. And I think just every so often in your life, you will land a dream project. Maybe it's only once, maybe it's five times, you will land a dream project. And I think I just found reserves of strength in myself that I never knew I had that would take me through to the conclusion of getting this book out. Maybe it's because I've written books and I'll read before. It's just I knew I was going to finish it. I knew I was going to do it.
And how did you, like, you said there was all this like huge body of material. Like, how did you have to develop a kind of a new process in terms of writing, like to just dig through all that, how you wanted to sort it? Like, the work of writing any book is like so much, but then doing a biography and like you said, having a responsibility or feeling like you do to do it justice, and be fair and all of that. Like, was there a process that you had to kind of invent, to help yourself do that?
But I considered a number of options. One is because of the volume of material, I thought about splitting it into a three volume biography. But then I had to take into mind commercial considerations, and I thought, well, if I do that, it might become too hagiographic. I don't, it's fascinating to me, but I don't think every reader out there wants to know where Alroy is on every particular day of his life. I want it to reflect Alroy's personality, which was to be fast moving and intense and obsessive and a real page turner for it to be like an Alroy novel. So, I mean, I remember one decision I made about midway through when I saw the volume of material and I saw the pacing of it was going to be very, very fast because Alroy lives fast and he's juggling a lot of things, is that I broke the chapters down. I basically doubled the number of chapters, but I didn't make the book longer. I just broke them down to make it easier to read and just to make that speed go faster. I don't I know a lot of writers thrive on structure and order, but I wouldn't know what I would be doing on certain days because an interview request might come in. It might be a Hollywood person. So now when you're dealing with a Hollywood person, you don't want to lose your chance to interview them. So if they say, I'll talk to you at this time, which happens to be 2 a.m. UK time, you're like, yeah, sure. Just say, yeah. So then I would just put aside what I was doing and focus on that interview. I have a friend, a New York-based writer called Jill Derman, who's run a few novels. And she says, to be a good writer, make sure you do an hour a day. And she's often surprised that people say, oh, an hour a day, that's nowhere near enough. Well, maybe not, but like a lot of writers end up not doing that hour. And then you've lost so much. If you've done an hour a day, you've done a good day's work as a writer because it's not easy. And when you're really flying, you can do much more than that. So that was it. Because like I'd spend many more hours like plowing through documents, like legal forms and oh, you know, everything from high school yearbooks to divorce records, marriage records, property records, electoral registers, anything that would either prove this person existed at this time or would help me track someone down, you know.
It's great to hear, and I like how you said that it wasn't so much that you created these rules or anything. It was just kind of you were flowing with it, and I think it shows in the final product too. How the flows into each section, and you kind of get this fast pace from a biography. It's just, I'm always fascinated by writers' methods, so that's why I'm always asking. And this is kind of a writing podcast.
Yeah,
Listeners
sure.
like to know that stuff here. So yeah, very cool. And it shows, yeah. With the title, very good title for that. Where did you
Thank
get
you.
that? How did it come from? How did it come about?
Well, Let Me Face and Danger is the last line of Alroy's novel White Jazz, and that was one that left me particularly breathless. And I remember that last line in particular always just hit me in the heart, and it just grabbed me. And it's a funny one, and I'd thought about it being the title of the biography when I first started, and I was like, and then I got a bit put off. I was like, no, it's a bit long, and I just had a working title like James Ellroy, the biography. And one day James says to me, "Oh, Steve, that's too flat," and he wanted to call it something called like The Night Runner, over after an old film noir called The Night Runner he's very fond of. And then he's like, and then he was saying things like running the night running man, or run is a strong verb, Steve, have you thought about run? He kept hanging on this word running. So I said, James, why don't I just call it Love Me First in Danger? And he's like, oh, that's amazing, that's fabulous. I was like, what was that about running? He's like, no, forget running. Scrap running. No, Love Me Fierce and Danger is the title. And he sent me a case of Johnnie Walker whiskey. He was so thrilled. He doesn't drink. He's an alcoholic, so we can't drink. And he said, this is stuff I would drink if I could. And he was absolutely thrilled with that title.
I love that he was had a little bit of an input in that too. I love that. That's great. Fantastic. Moving on a little bit, Elroy and movie adaptations, kind of the adaptations of his work. From what I've read of him, and again, I'm nowhere near as well versed in it as you are. He seems to not like any of them, and just kind of your idea of why do you think that is, or at least why do his books, again, maybe because they're so big, but like, why do they never seem to translate well into film projects, at least to his liking, or.
Oh, excellent question. Well, with LA Confidential, it's slightly odd because that's the version that almost everybody likes. You know, it's considered a critic's darling of a film and one of the great neo-noir films, but Elroy doesn't like it. And he's grown to hate it. I think it's partly the size. It's partly that vividness. And Elroy finds Hollywood very sanitized when it comes to sex and violence and just much more formulaic. I mean, he's worked as a screenwriter, so he knows how movies are made. It's definitely not a writer's forum, the act of movie making. You know, a lot of most movies are factory written, so there'll be a team of writers on it, but there'll only be one credited writer because I think we as consumers like the idea that this is all a figment of, say, one man's imagination or two people's at most. But it's not like that. The writers, you know, they're being ordered to do rewrites at the whim of a director or a star or something like that. I think a lot of writers hate it because it's good money, but it's a but they have no autonomy over the work. I think the reason, I mean, but the a reason why we're not going to see many more Elroy novels at least being filmed, at least in the foreseeable future, is like because he writes series and these kind of, but they're not kind of consecutively ordered series. They're much more kind of, he's got his own universe that he's created. The characters are crossing over, and when you get that into studio politics, the studios have certain rights to certain characters, so other novels cannot be adapted. But you know, LA Confidential has mixed feelings about. I mean, we remember it as the Oscar-winning classic, and I do think that that's definitely the best Elroy film. And I think Elroy's too harsh on it. Black Dahlia is a bit of a disaster.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that one. Yeah.
I mean, large swathes of it are incoherent, and I have a soft spot for Cop, which is based on Blood of the Moon, and it was directed by James B. Harris. Which so that one has a contemporary setting with James Woods and is based on one of Elroy's earlier novels. And I know Elroy hates it. He's very fond of James B. Harris, who's now in his 90s and is still going strong. He was very generous and wonderful with me. But I just think Elroy's too d daring for Hollywood. And one of the things he's writing about is just the absurdity of celebrity and the absurdity of and the facade of Hollywood. And he's penetrating that, and I don't think the studios particularly want to go there. The Warner Brothers did not believe in LA Confidential. They tried to bury it. They wanted a very small release for it. They wanted, I think, a September release. They wanted to give it the commercial kiss of death. It was very much Curtis Hanson who saved it because he knew the critics were going to like it. He was instrumental in getting it shown at the Cannes Film Festival. Where you knew the French critics and European critics particularly would be able to build some momentum for it. And you know, and he did. He really managed to defy a lot of Warner Brothers' expectations for the film.
Yeah, I love that. I love hearing about like when it's always like one person that just believed in it and just changed the trajectory of this thing that, yeah, could have been buried, could have been pulled from release entirely. I guess they might have spent too much money on it to do that, but yeah, it's always fascinating with writers and film adaptations, particularly, you know, novelists. I think Stephen King famously doesn't really like most of the movie adaptations of his stuff, and that's what made him his huge reputation, made him what he is today. So I don't know if it's just something like, oh, it's your baby, and like you see somebody kind of, you know, cut into it and kind of chop it up, or yeah, I guess. I mean, I'm sure was he very open about talking about his disdain for the movies and.
When he wanted to vent, he would really talk lay into the movies. Yeah, absolutely. And it was a little bit sad because he grew rather wary of Curtis Hanson. I think they had a kind of late falling out. And that was partly over plans for LA Confidential 2, which Elroy never lost his enthusiasm for doing LA Confidential 2. They were close a number of times, and it kept falling through. It got complicated. He felt that Curtis Hanson had treated Brian Helgeland shabbily. Brian Helgeland, the co-writer, who's later became a director himself. I mean, I spoke to Brian, and he didn't really feel that way. He didn't make out that they'd had any kind of been treated shabbily. I do know that Brian Helgeland wrote most of L.A. Confidential. Curtis Hanson's contribution to the script was rather minimal, and then Curtis directed it. So again, there were things that went on behind the scenes. I mean, some of them were really funny. James Cromwell didn't want to say Boyo in L.A. Confidential, because Dudley Smith's a dyed-in-the-wool Irishman, and Boyo is a Welsh term. Now I'm Welsh. Well, I'm English, but I've got a Welsh dad. I must admit, I've never heard an Irishman say Boyo, and it's more of an older Welsh thing. But anyway, Elroy was insistent, and Curtis Hanson was insistent because they're like, well, this is LA, it's not really Ireland or Wales. And Curtis Hanson brought an academic or some sort of kind of linguistic expert on the set to say, oh, yeah, Boyo is Welsh, it's not Irish. And Curtis Hanson had to get Elroy on the phone, and who then chewed James Cromwell out over the phone over this incident. It all just seemed very funny, the egos that were at stake.
That's great. Yeah, that's was Elroy on was he contracted to be a main writer for the LA Confidential too?
Yeah, he was going to be the main writer. At one point, because there were several attempts to do it. One, when Curtis was still alive in the mid-noughties. And then when did Curtis die? Was it 2016? Anyway, there was an attempt to do it after Curtis had passed around 2019 with just Elroy and Brian Helgeland. And at one point, the studios tried to phase Elroy out. And Brian Helgeland said, I will only do it if James is doing it with me, all the way. And James was really touched by that. And I know Brian Helgeland's a great guy. And it would have been great. I mean, it would have been very, very special because 20 years had passed since the first film. If they were going to get Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce back, obviously they're 20 years older themselves. And the Kevin Spacey Jack Vincennes character is dead, and nobody wants Kevin Spacey in the movie anymore anyway. So what Brian Helgeland thought to do was, like, if we're going to make it three cops, it's got to be the 1970s now, and I'd like there to be a black cop in the mix alongside Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce. And he wanted Chadwick Boseman for the role. This is a few years before Chadwick Boseman died, obviously.
Right.
And I think that would have been amazing. That would have just been, I think, seeing Boseman, Russell Crowe, Guy Pearce up on screen, the three of them, in L.A. Confidential 2, it would have been amazing. But the studios didn't buy it. They shopped it around everywhere. They couldn't sell it.
Yeah, it's always a tragedy when you hear about those Hollywood failures, what could have been a casting, what could have been made, what almost got made, what got made and then got shelved. And yeah. And you've had this love of crime fiction, since a young kid. You ever try to write it yourself or
I've written a lot of fiction. I've had some short stories published in Apocalypse Confidential. It's a good magazine. I wouldn't say it's necessarily Elroy. I mean, some of it has been Elroy. It's particularly themes of, like, voyeurism, and that I kind of developed very much from him. Some of it's been more my interest, like, kind of, I have a fondness for kind of courtroom settings because I would love to have been a lawyer in another life. So some of it has reflected that. I just feel like being an academic, it's consumed so much of my time. And I know the industry backwards and forwards. You don't need an agent to be an ac to get an academic book published. Your reputation is your agent, and you can approach academic publishers, and they're just very receptive for me. And it just seems like the fiction world, it moves so slowly. in terms of getting the agents and the editors' attentions. But I think you might see some fiction from me in the future, but you'll certainly still as well see more nonfiction, kind of scholarship research. I think it's just the direction of my career has kind of gone that way.
Yeah. What, going off of that, what I have this fascination as somebody who, I went to college for writing and English and all of that, and my MFA and all that in the US here. And it was just, but I've always been fascinated by crime and pulp fiction. I know that's kind of, it's almost a dirty word when you go into the kind of literary side of the academia and all that, where I got my degrees from. But I've always been like, no, there's something to this that just captivates, like you said, the imagination, the adventure, this kind of, what is it about crime pulp fiction that we like so much, or that draws people's attention so much? Or what would you say? No definitive answers, but.
Well, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about the same question, particularly at the moment where I think thanks to DNA profiling, the clearance rate for homicide cases has vastly improved. It's almost like we're looking for a good mystery because the number of actual mysteries are going down. I think obviously we love the unknown. We're slightly fascinated by people who break the law for whatever reason. If they commit the ultimate crime, obviously to take someone else's life, why would they do that? Is it a crime passionnel, or if it's for some other malign purpose, be it ideological or financial, whatever, it's just like organized crime, which is basically just an underworld corporation. I mean, there's many reasons. I think pulp fiction really taps into those fascinations and into the taboos and what is quirky and what is just society turned on its head. Pulp fiction has a real way of getting into that.
Yeah, I wonder if I'm just thinking of this now. The kind of rise in horror and kind of fantasy or sci-fi, I wonder if that's almost taking the place because, like you said, with technology, it's kind of, I don't know, made it more less of a mystery when somebody's killing someone and there's like a hair left behind or a drop of sweat. You can now figure all that out. When I've been, like I said, I've been doing this series on the Ian Fleming Bond novels with a friend, and he said to me, mobile phones, he said, it kind of ruined the spy genre because now if you have a little mobile phone in your pocket as it pings off a tower every 15 minutes, a local cop could find your location like with one search, let alone a huge international spy agency or something. You think that maybe that's like why it's gone more into the kind of, not that pulp has gone down, there's still a huge, a huge audience for crime and pulp stuff, but yeah, this kind of rise in the kind of sci-fi fantasy mystery, where the kind of supernatural, I guess, is the term I'm looking for, more so than the like hard-boiled crime stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why people are fascinated by superheroes as well, people who can break the natural law, because I mean, there's so much we can do with technology. I mean, I find humans are amazing in themselves, they're amazing beings. Maybe pulp is about when we break down, in a sense, isn't that when we fail because we become obsessed with the neighbor who gets undressed near her bedroom window or wherever, that little taboo, that little weakness in ourselves. I think, and I'm not into superheroes really. That's not my taste. Speculative fiction, maybe a little bit. And that itself has some fears and taboos because we don't know where the technology is going, whether, we might be heading down the route of wherever designer babies or whatever thing in science. There's usually something in science, a technology, a discovery around the corner that will turn our ethics on their head. That in itself is quite interesting. That's a similarity that it has with, say, detective fiction. And there were some crossover writers like Philip K. Dick who could cross over that very well. There's a very good, actually, the Portuguese-British writer, Patricia Marquez, who's doing a very good crossover work right now. She writes, her first novel was called The Colours of Death, and it's set in this world where a segment of the population are telepathic and telekinetic. And so she examines it from the point of view as to how that affects police investigations and that sort of thing. So I think maybe that's something good that we can take from that there's some interesting crossovers popping up.
Yeah, absolutely. And who was it? Was it a playwright that said that like most of drama is just seeing somebody do something bad, right? Like even when they're people said the literary side would dismiss crime or pulp, but it's like, well, it's the same principle. So the good literary stuff is the same thing. Like, you want to see somebody do something bad, and then the consequences and the kind of chain of events starts happening. And yeah, it's just so fascinating. I think that that's. I have a deep passion for it, like, because of that, because it's so directly to the point with those kind of. I want to know what happens too. That kind of it's a great medium to what happens next, which is, the big driver of all this kind of stuff, writing stories and reading stories. But I have another question here. It's a little different, but I'm fascinated by this concept because I've been thinking about it recently. Where is crime fiction or pulp fiction? Is it inherently masculine or male, or male coded, as they say online, or something? What do you think about that?
I think it may have been just because of demographics, say 70 years ago, in that it was more chauvinistic society, so it was harder for women to break into, the male-dominated world of publishing. But I mean, I think our love of mystery really crosses genders. It depends what you mean by masculine. But if by masculine you mean male, or if you just if by masculine perhaps you mean violent or immoral, it could depend. But certainly, I think now some of the greatest writers of crime fiction and pulp are female, and Megan Abbott, Lisa Marklund, Camilla Läckberg, and even writers of 20, 30 years ago who've now passed away, like Ruth Rendell, P.D. James, Mo Hayder was a recent discovery of mine. I mean, I could go on and on. There's so many great women writers in crime fiction, and looking at, say, publishing and literary agents. I mean, I don't know the exact figures, but if anything, they seem to be more female dominated than male dominated. Every agent and editor I know tends to be female. So I think women are great readers of the genre and great practitioners of the genre. So attitudes are changing, and just like. When you read, if you pick up a novel now, then there will naturally be LGBT characters, there will be people of color, and there will be all manner of diverse people, because it just reflects the society we live in.
Yeah, I think that's a because I've just been thinking about that kind of like, is it yeah, and is it just historical like kind of precedent that was set, or is it yeah, is it because of the fact that most murderers are men or something, and it's just like the violence that is kind of yeah, gets a pulp story going is usually ends up being somebody killing somebody or mystery death or yeah, fascinating stuff. this is more writing question. Because we like those here on Heavy Board. What is your writing routine like?
It differs from day to day. I get up, I jump on my exercise bike, so I like to do a bit of physical activity, and to get the juices flowing. And then I just get to work on my laptop. I could be researching, I could be writing, I could be doing a bit of both. But like, I follow Jill Damon's advice and make sure that I've done my hour, and I will hopefully do much more of that because I've got to go to work, I've got to go to the office as well. But that's in the afternoon, the mornings I have to myself. So I do it in the morning. I mean, when I was a student, when I was doing my PhD, I'd often do an all-nighter and I'd just be drinking energy drinks and that sort of stuff. I don't want to do that anymore. I'm 45. I just like, I want to be kinder to my body because, I think that's just what it's going to make my brain function better. So I might set a target. I might want to write 500 words. I might want to write 1,000, or I might want to write more. If I'm really flying, if I'm in white heat type mode, I can write, 5,000 or more. The most I ever got quoted is an American writer called Ryan Jarn. Have you heard of him?
No.
I saw him at Harrogate, Figston's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival in Harrogate here, and he said he can write 12,000 words in a day. That's got to be the record that I've had anyone mention ever to me. But I can write 5,000 words, maybe more. But it literally depends on the day, and there will be days where I just flop out. But I try not to beat myself up about it. I would have done once, but now I'm more sanguine about it. A lot of things I have to write tend might be things like proposals or reports or things like that. And you know what? They're just as important as a manuscript or a short story. I do tell people, aspiring writers, write every day, even if it's just the emails at work, because every time you write something, be it big or small, you're making decisions. That's the key. You're deciding how formal to be, how flirty to be, how familiar, how funny, or how professional. And you're making decisions and you're solving problems. And that's what writing's all about, I feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. I love that answer. And we always, I mean, again, because this is a writing and reading podcast here, they like to know this kind of thing. So we got the routine. How do you make a living? Because I know it's tough out there for writers right now. And I know you mentioned the academic gig and stuff. Do you make any off the literature? We don't have to get into any numbers or anything like that. But just, yeah, how do you make a living as a writer? It's tough out there.
Yeah, I have to work.
Right.
I've got a mortgage, so I make some money off the books, and that's got a bit better over the years. But I've taught and I've lectured and I've worked in academic libraries. I've done all manner of jobs. Luckily, I'm at the stage now. I mean, I've done retail jobs. I've worked in cafes and that sort of thing, but I haven't done that for a while. I'm quite fortunate that my work over recent years has all been quite academically based, but I'm not the sort of academic. In fact, thank God, I'm not the sort of academic who's just work 70 hours a week, and his career is completely rooted around the university he or she works at. I've got many friends who do that. I have nothing but reverence and admiration and respect for them, but I don't think I could do that. And in many ways, they look at me and say, "Oh, Steve, you're writing books. You've got a certain freedom and God allowed you to do what you do. So, in many ways, you've got it a bit better." So, yeah, I get by. I get by. I don't want anyone to think that I'm super rich or anything like that. So.
I don't even think that's possible anymore as a writer. Yeah, like those days are done.
Exactly.
And we're getting towards some of the final questions here. What advice would you give out to writers that are starting out, like younger writers or people that are aspiring to write crime or even in the academic life and things like that?
Well, I'd probably say first and foremost, don't be afraid of failure. In fact, embrace failure a little bit. Embrace, rejection or whatever. You will get rejection, and it's important that you listen to it, and especially in regards to listening to the advice, which is quite easy to look up online as to what literary agents want, what editors want, and doing it to a T. Don't let your ego get in your way. Don't you think oh, my work is so strong that I don't have to follow these guidelines. You do. Those are just professional guidelines that any other professional follows. Work on your stamina, because that's one thing you'll need more than anything. Because it's very nice when we get an idea in our head and we think, I don't think anyone's done that before. Fantastic. And then you put it into a manuscript. But then you realize you have to change it a little bit, and suddenly the task gets longer and longer. So your stamina, you'll need more than anything. But don't give up. Don't be afraid of failure. In fact, be afraid of not failing. Every book I've done, I think, turned out pretty well, but there was something in it that broke my heart, and that's why I keep doing it. I think if I ever write the perfect book, I'll stop. So I keep doing it, because every book the book I'm doing usually leads to the next one, because I have ideas that I want to develop, and just keep going. I think if you look at guys like Al Roy, one of the reasons we're still reading him, and that he didn't just write one book and then quit and do something else, is that he just kept going and going and going and going. So, like, we're continually drawn back to what he does. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and you see Elroy, somebody who's writing, I mean, those lengthy books, like, the even into his older age now, is still churning out these, 1,000-page novels that are just, yeah, I mean, the only way to maintain that is to just keep doing it, until you can't anymore or whatever. It's yeah, great stuff. Great stuff. What We like to ask this as well. What are you reading right now? Anything good, or watching anything good, or it doesn't have to be crime related or anything like that, right? It could be academic, or it could be.
Well, at the moment, I'm doing a lot of rereading, because the YouTube channel you mentioned earlier, Elroy Reads, the basic thrust of it is I took every video I took for a book that was influential to Elroy. Now, as it happens, I've probably read everything Elroy's read. That's one thing just a biographer does to soak up that atmosphere. But to make this YouTube series, I just went back and reread the books. Right now I'm rereading The Choir Boys by Joseph Wambao, and that's a remarkable, very funny portrait of the LAPD in the 1970s. So different to policing today. I got to interview Wambao twice. The first time was great because it was about his books. The second time was a disaster because it was for the Elroy biography, and let's just say some writers aren't very good at talking about other writers, and it became a bit comical. But I admire him greatly. I think Wambao is one of the greats, because we've talked for a few of the greats this evening, and it's worth mentioning Joseph Wambao. He was very pleased, actually, that I'd read a book of his called The Blooding, which was about the discovery of DNA profiling at the University of Leicester in the UK in the 1980s, which cracked a murder case. It solved a murder case of two girls, and of course now DNA profiling is everywhere. Basically, what the police did was the first major DNA case. It was a small village in Leicester, then, and they knew the killer was a man who lived in one of these villages. So they took a blood sample of every single man in the village until it matched the killers. It's quite primitive DNA technology compared to what we do today, where they'd be swabbed and there'd be a computer database of everybody's DNA profile. But yeah, Wambao wrote a great book about that called The Blooding, and he was very pleased that I'd read it, because I don't think it sold very well in America. But so it's a big story over here.
That's great. How's the YouTube channel going?
Going good, yeah. Send me some of your subscribers. I'm keen on, building the audience. I'm getting more subscribers every time I post. I'm trying to post once a week. It's going great. I'm enjoying it. It's a bit different being in front of the camera, than just being the voice on the page. And it's going really well. I'm really pleased with it.
Yeah, I do cross post with like YouTube for the podcast and stuff, but it's strange to me how much YouTube is social media now. Like, it's kind of like just like it's like a long form social media where you're making like these long form videos and people are commenting and liking and sharing and all that. So I'm always fascinated, especially for books. You know, it's rough out there with the books, the book channels. Yeah. Nobody's reading the books.
I know it's hard to persuade people to buy books anymore. I mean, I think it's the same. If you look what's happened to the music industry, it's that people don't want to pay for it anymore. I mean, they still want the product, but they want it for free. And Elroy said something about this, like a book is a terrific investment. For $20 or so, you have bought yourself, you know, a friend, a companion, you know, an intellectual stimulus, something that's going to, you know, keep you company in moments where you're down, and also, you know, just keep you entertained and informed and engaged. So that's advice I'd repeat. Do not hesitate. Go out and buy yourself a book, because it can get so dispiriting when you see people constantly scrolling and constantly taking in information on their phone, you know, in this tidbit fashion, which is obviously very limiting.
Yeah, it's music's a good comparison for that, because the same thing. You buy an album, you own it forever now, and you can go back to it. You keep getting pleasure from it every time you go back, and you could reread or re-listen to something. And I guess audiobooks, but even audiobooks are doing about the same sales as physical books. Yeah. So, is there an audiobook version of this yet out? Or?
Yeah, there is. There's an audiobook version of Love Me First in Danger, which you can get on Audible. It's narrated by Jeff Harding, an American narrator who's based in the UK. He's very good. He's narrated many, many audiobooks, including many of, if not all of Elroy's novels. And that's why I recommended him, actually. I said, there's this guy who's been doing Elroy's novels, audiobooks. It'd be just perfect if he did the biography, and he did. And he did it wonderfully. He did a wonderful job.
That's fantastic. Final question here. We always like to ask writers that come on, what are you working on now? What are your projects? What are your obsessions right now that you're going over? So I know you're still doing, you're still doing all the press stuff, and you have to go fly to the US for these awards coming up. But what are you working on now?
Well, manuscript-wise, I'm just superstitious. I can't go into too much detail because I know I will curse it. And I'm at that stage, obviously, where I'm looking for editors and I'm looking for people who are get interested. I mean, I will repeat what I mentioned earlier because this is official. I'm doing this special Elroy issue of Clues, a Journal of Detection, which I'm very excited about. So we've sent out the call for papers. We've circulated it we've just started, but we're circulating it throughout European and North American universities. We hope that many young research postgraduates and also young early career academics or academics at any stage of their career are going to be submitting us articles about James Elroy. We're broadly setting the theme around the 30th anniversary of American Tabloid. I'm just really, really excited about it because Clues is the greatest journal of crime fiction, without a doubt. And I've been reading it for years. And the thought of just editing an edition is just a real thrill for me. And I'm working with a friend and colleague called Nathan Ashman, who's also a great Elroy scholar, and he wrote James Elroy and Voyeur Fiction, which was a full-length monograph study of Elroy, which is really, really good. So we're enjoying it. We're excited. And a week after the Edgars, I've also been nominated for the HRF Keating Award for Best Biography. Love Me First in Danger has been nominated for that. So a week after the Edgars, I'm going down to Bristol in Southwest England for the Crime Fest festival, which is the biggest crime writing festival in the UK, and that's where the award ceremony will be. So Wish me luck, and wish me luck for the Eggers.
Yeah, I hope so. This will be delayed a few weeks, but I hope by the time it comes out, we already know. And yeah, you're holding your little you're holding that award. It'd be a nice little sticker on the book for you. So we're holding out hope. But that was it. Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to do this, Stephen. Drop your handles and all of your socials and all that for people to follow you. YouTube channel, Venetian Vase, and all that.
On X, I'm at Alroy Reader. My YouTube channel is Alroy Reads, and my website is www.venetianvase.co.uk. Easily findable just by Googling Venetian Vase. That's where you can find me in the majority. That's where I am.
Fantastic. Go check it out, listeners. And all that will be linked below as well. Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time. This has been fantastic.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and this has been another episode of Heavy Board.
Heavy.
Board.
Heavy.
I am heavy, heavy, heavy
board.
Sweats and the day sweats, pal? Pal, I do.
If you're hearing this, it's because you are listening to the free public feed of Heavy Board. To get complete, uncensored, uninterrupted, full access to this podcast, become a subscriber at patreon.com/heavyboard. That's right, Heavy Board is made possible by subscribers like you. For less than one cup of coffee per month, you will receive private access to uncensored, full-length episodes, Jerk Shop, heavy bonus content, subscribers-only AMA episodes, bonus extended interviews, and more. Come join the conversation today at patreon.com/heavyboard.